Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of the DINFOS Way, a podcast developed and produced at the Defense Information School. This program is dedicated to developing and showcasing the skills of military communicators, public affairs professionals, and industry experts from all over the world. I'm your host, Jack Rouse. I'm a former Navy and civilian journalist, and I'm a current training specialist here at DINFOS. Our guest today is New York Times bestselling author Jim Butcher. Mr. Butcher is the writer and creator of the Dresden Files, the Codex Alera, and the Cinder Spires book series. His immensely popular works have been printed and shared all over the world, and the Dresden Files books have been adapted into a TV show on the Sci-Fi Network and a tabletop role-playing game. Mr. Butcher is a master of the art of storytelling, and he joins us today to talk about his life and works, the differences between short-form and long-form storytelling, and the keys to creating and maintaining a devoted audience. Mr. Butcher, thank you for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
Thank you. How are you today, sir?
Can't complain. Got about 2 feet of snow, and I'm all kind of bunkered in with a pantry full of food and a bunch of wood ready for the fireplace, and I'm enjoying it.
That sounds great. We didn't get much snow here, so I'm weirdly jealous. Well, if you don't mind, sir, could you please kind of start by giving our audience a quick summary of the path you kind of took from wanting to be a successful writer to New York Times bestselling author?
Well, I started off in high school, and this will tell you too much about me, because I was a senior in high school, and we were in our last semester, and so I was doing the cool senior thing and skipping class, you know, in that last month or so. But as I was such a nerd, I skipped the class and went to the library to read. So I'm in there when the vice principal in charge of discipline comes in. You know, he was the guy everybody was afraid of. His name was Leroy Brown. So bad Leroy Brown
right.
walks in and sees me skipping class, and I'm like, oh, no. And Mr. Brown says, oh, you must be here for the author talk. I'm like, yes, I am here for the author talk. And he says, okay, great, you can help me set up chairs. So I did. And Margaret Weiss, one of the writers of the Dragonlance Chronicles, and who was also a native of Independence, Missouri, my hometown, showed up to talk. And she gave a talk about being a writer. And I was just floored by it because, I mean, my gosh, here was a person that was from my town. And if she had done it, maybe I could do it too. And so that was when I started thinking about it really hard. And then it was the next year that I wrote my first novel. And, you know, it was awful. But that's okay because, you know, the first step to being good at something is to be terrible at it, but you have to try it. So the year after that, I wrote another novel and another novel the year after that, and another novel the year after that. And meanwhile, you know, I was in taking English courses, everything I could find about writing in college. I didn't know there was a rivalry between the English department and the journalism department, though, because the journalism department had one of the only professional writing tracks in the country. And so I didn't find out about that until after I had my bachelor's in English. So I went for my master's in professional writing and journalism. And it was there that I met Debbie Chester, who started showing me how to sort of break down all the writing that I loved into its separate elements and to see how it had been built and constructed. And then started teaching me the craft of storytelling, which is very much a craft and it's very much about technique. And I started learning from her, and eventually, after about 10 years of trying, I finally sold my first novel.
And you had three novels in the can before you got published for the first time. How valuable was it having those books, that writing experience, already in the can before you got published?
Well, it was super valuable in terms of being treated seriously by the publisher as a new writer, because they knew they already had a bunch of work that was ready to go that they wouldn't have to work very hard on to publish. And when you're the new guy, the most thing that they're concerned about is not wasting too much money on you. So if you can provide them with a manuscript that's not going to cost them a lot of hours to clean up and is basically just kind of going to kind of fit easily into their chain, that's great. And plus, they were publishing books about once every 9 months when I was getting started, based on that first, you know, they had kind of a rush schedule because they had all three books at first, which put me on a pretty sharp and difficult production schedule for the first part of my career, which wound up being very good for me because, you know, books were coming out pretty quickly and the audience was pretty happy with that.
Absolutely. Kind of since you touched on it a little bit, can you tell us sort of what your writing process is and how it's evolved from fledgling writer to where it is today?
Well, When I was first a writer, I just wrote whatever seemed to be the next step in the book, and it wasn't really very good. You know, my original, I don't know, about seven novels. I think the first Dresden File book was the eighth novel I'd written. And those first seven novels, I would not have made Osama bin Laden read them. You know, I just dislike anyone that much. But they were terrible. I wound up scrapping them for parts, and you know, I would take a character from here or there that I had done all right with, and I'd put them in new books and so on. But my basic process these days is the exact same as what I learned in college. You know, I have a basic outline for every scene where I know where, you know, I have an idea of what's going to be happening. When I'm writing the interscene portions of the book where characters are reflecting and thinking and figuring out what to do next, those are called sequels in the writing game. And, you know, I learned how to do my sequels and how to do them in the proper psychological order so that people would kind of intuitively understand everything without needing to be, you know, told all the details. And, So now, you know, now when I'm writing a scene, you know, I used to have to, you know, bust out a piece of line paper and a notebook paper and figure out, okay, this is what's going to be going on and this is what's going to be happening here. But as I practiced that more and more, you know, eventually I didn't need the paper. That's just how the scenes get built in my head. So I don't worry about it too much. But the way I write is I start off with, I know where I'm going to begin the book. I know what kind of the big flashy middle part of the book is going to be. And I know what the climax of the book is going to be. And, once I know that, then I can get started. And on each individual scene or sequel, the way I write is I stop it. I think about what's going to happen in the next one. And I don't write it until I have it all clear in my head. And once I have an idea, okay, this is exactly what's going to happen, and I've got like a little movie in my head running, then I just write the text that describes the movie, and you know, then I go get a Coke and I feel good about myself. But the problem with writing like that is the good parts of it are that you get a very clean manuscript when you're done. You know, so it's generally speaking, they only need to be very lightly edited because I've had a good idea in mind of what I was doing the whole time. The negative part of that is that it's sort of like a samurai doing a painting, you know, well, they settle down in front of the big blank piece of paper and they just stare at it. They take up their brush and they stare and they stare and they stare. And then they go, shh, horse, you know, and it's just done like that. But that staring part is a long process. And so, you know, there a lot of times, you know, it'll be a week or 2 weeks before I know what I'm doing next because I haven't figured out, you know, what makes that scene special in my head and what makes it good.
Wow.
But once I know, then it just comes out really quick. I mean, you know, I write about 2,500 words an hour.
Oh my gosh.
I've done as much as 6,000 in an hour before, when I was really on, but,
that's an incredible output. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you've got those huge pauses in front of it, you know, but once I know what I'm doing, it's pretty quick.
So how important is feedback to your work and what you do?
For me, it's critical. I write to a live audience. I've got an audience of beta readers, and as I finish each chapter, I post the chapter, and it goes up on a web page, and there's a web form underneath with three fields on it, and three fields say, what did you like about this chapter? What did you dislike about this chapter? Did you have any questions? And I find that by looking at these three fields, I can pretty much diagnose what's going on with the story, and I keep a fairly broad, intellectually diverse selection of folks who read for me. So you know, they come from all different perspectives, and although now that I think about it, I don't think any of them are writers themselves. Some of them are working on it. I guess that's true, but. But yeah, I want, you know, I've got a collection of nerds that I send my stuff to, and my fellow nerds read up on it and give me their reactions. And I can tell if I'm doing a good job. You know, I can tell, you know, if I've got a villain that is really scoring, people will be writing all about that villain in the dislike section, you know, like that. And if I've managed to convince them that somebody, you know, that they previously thought was a villain is a different character now, then I see it in the like section, you know, if they're wondering about the plot, their stuff comes up in their question section, and so it lets me know, okay, I'm doing a good job, or I haven't, you know, brought this, you know, I haven't brought this character around enough, or I haven't shown this character well enough, and you know, I do find, though, that when I go back, the mistakes that I make are always in fundamentals. And like, I mean, it's like any other skill you want to master. It's always fundamentals.
Hmm. One of the very first things you said was how important the art of storytelling is, because it's actually an art and it's something that you have to work at. Can you expand on that for me and kind of tell me more about your feelings and thoughts on the art of storytelling?
All right. Okay. First of all, let me start. First of all, with the question, I don't think that storytelling is an art. I think there's artistry to it, but I don't think it's useful to think of it as an art, because that tends to make. I also don't think it's useful to think of art as art, because that tends to kind of put this mysticism to it, when really there is so much nuts and bolts carpentry to it. Like, if you want to learn how to draw, you know, and how to paint, how to do beautiful, brilliant art, there is so much, you know, tab A, slot B work you've got to do first. You know, that you've got to learn. Okay, this is the proportions of the human body. Here's how you do different angles. Here's how you simulate that, you know, on a flat page so that the eye translates it as three dimensional. You know, there's all this stuff, and writing's no different. You know, you go into it. And it's a lot like carpentry. You spend a lot of time, you know, lining up corners and making sure, you know, measuring twice and making sure your lines are straight. Because if you're careful about, you know, each piece as you put it together, the whole goes together a lot more smoothly. So there's artistry that comes into it, but it's much like working carpentry. You know, a master carpenter doesn't go to his workbench to build a beautiful carved wooden box and think to himself, okay, I'm going to have to use my T-square and my pencil and I'm going to have to get out this kind of paper and I'm going to need this sort of wood. You know, he already knows all that because he's done it so often that is all just sort of, all of the nuts and bolts part of it are just sort of ingrained into him. You know, and he doesn't have to stop and think about things. He's at his workbench. He's always there. He just starts reaching without even looking, you know, for the different things he's going to need and setting them out, because he's already thinking about the beautiful carving that he's going to be doing later and what he needs to do to make sure that he's got a solid foundation before he starts in on the pretty carving, because you also, you know, when you're building a box, you need it to be a good box. And stories are the same way. There's lots of nuts and bolts that you put together, and it feels very artificial and mechanical and rigid when you first start learning it. But once you learn the basics, once you learn the foundation, then you can kind of start doing that without thinking about it, which frees up your head to start thinking about, well, how am I going to do the artistry of this? And that's where the art comes in. You know, it's like, okay, I know that because of my nuts and bolts craft teaching that I've learned, I know I'm going to have to have this. I'm going to have a villain that is doing this in this particular part of the story. Okay, so but I don't worry about, well, how do I build villains, or how do I introduce, you know, a villainous character? Yeah, I don't have to think about that. I already know kind of the basics of how to do that. So what I'm thinking about is, well, how do I bring this guy in who's a villain but also funny? And how do I bring in this person who is a villain, you know, but also he's got this sense of honor and he's admirable, and how do I show that best to the audience? You know, do I make that something that's hidden and gets revealed later, or do I bring it out right on the surface? You know, how is it going to interact with the rest of the story? How will it interact with the overstory? Because, you know, whenever I'm writing a book, I'm just writing one story at a time, and I have to make it fit into the overstory, which is why it's getting harder and harder to do as I keep going along. But there's a balance of artistry and just solid know-how. And I think that exists in absolutely any skill, you know, any sport, any art, any other endeavor that you care to name. You know, there's the solid, I know this is going to work and this is how it goes together. And, you know, this is how we make sure the machine goes. And then there's, but how do I make it beautiful? And that goes on top of that.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because that's essentially what we teach here at Dinfos. You know, you've got to have a solid grasp of the fundamentals. And once you have a solid grasp of the fundamentals of any creative art, that's when you can start to be creative. But you've got to have those fundamentals. And, you know, do you think that that's sort of what good storytelling means to you, is a grasp of good fundamentals? Or what does good storytelling mean to you?
Well, I mean, for me, I'm writing to make a living. And so I want to sell to a broad audience. You know, I want to create something that a lot of people can look at and go, oh, I can see this world. I can believe in this world. This feels like a real place. You know? And in order to get to the widest number of people, you've got to have your basics down. You've got to have your fundamentals down. because that's how you communicate on a wide level. You've got to, you know, keep things, I would say simple, but simple isn't quite the right word. You got to keep things elegant. You know, they've got to be very clean. So when you're putting stuff, and fundamentals are what help you put together things very cleanly, very neatly. And it's only after that that you start worrying about the other stuff too. But fundamentally, I think of myself as a craftsman who just happens to be good at adding some pretty flares here and there. Mm.
So what makes for a great story then?
The core story is you've got a character, something happens to his world that puts everything out of balance. That character sets out to restore balance somehow. And he meets with just hideous adversity along the way. I mean, whatever it is, you know, there's going to be stuff getting in his way. There's going to be people going up against him, enemies and various other characters. And that character has to keep trying and failing and trying and failing and trying and failing until he finally wins through. And that is the ultimate story, because the story of most people's lives is not triumph. The story of most people's lives is this is hard. Whatever it is that they're doing, most people are not the folks who, they're not the person who soars to the top and just gets to stand there in the spotlight, but people who have to work and try and strive for a long time, and yet who do eventually win through, just if nothing else, through sheer tenacity. And you can also win through because of cleverness or because of strength that is drawn from your moral character or any number of other reasons. But at the end of the day, people want to read a story about somebody who does not win, who does not get to be homecoming king, who does not just triumph again and again. And especially in an American audience, Americans like an underdog. Mm-hmm. So you want that character who has to battle his way towards his victory. And when he gets there, you want the audience to go, wow, he worked through that. He deserved it. And it gives them that sense of completion and emotional satisfaction when they get to see that. When they get to see things set right despite everything that was up against them.
How hard is it inside of a great story to develop a great character, and how do you do that?
If you get your fundamentals down, it's not too hard. Well, it's one of those. Okay, I'm phrasing this incorrectly. It's one of those things that's simple, not easy. Mm. Lifting the engine block out of a car, that's simple, but it's not easy. Making a strong character is the same thing. I mean, it starts with your character's introduction, with who he is, with the sort of person he is. How does he come across to the audience? How do they think of him? In the way he interacts with other people in the world, is he this admirable person or is he shadier? And you can make shady characters who people absolutely love, and that's fine. But the way you do it is, you get your craft down, you make sure that you craft for characters is it can be very complex. You're talking about establishing tags and traits and kind of creating this excellent psychological image in people's mind of this character. And then you have to be consistent. And if you're consistent over time, that's really, I think, what makes a difference, especially in a long story like the one I'm doing. If Harry Dresden just jumped up and ran away to a beach in Mexico and hung out in a tequila bar, hitting on tourists, that would be a story, but it wouldn't be very Harry Dresden. People would look at that and go, "What the hell?" because it would blow the image. I mean, it would destroy the image that's been created over 17 books so far. So consistency, is really the key. Because if you start wavering from that, then people start going, oh, "Okay, you're just making stuff up as you go along," which is true. But you need to make it not feel like that to the reader. and consistency is the best way to do that. And so that's why it's very important, especially if you're doing a long story, that you kind of create a character profile, that you can go up and look up this character. It's like, okay, well, here's the words I use to identify him. Here's kind of his props that go along with him. Here's his history and the things he's done. Here's specifically, notable attitudes. For Harry Dresden, there's also an original D&D character sheet, the old ones with the little shield where you put some armor class.
That's so funny. I was just going to say, that's exactly what it sounds like, is an old school D&D character sheet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was where it started, and then he's got like this little profile biography thing that got going. But I kept that for a while, and then the fans started doing a wiki, and they worked way harder at it than I possibly could. So these days, I go check the fan wiki and make sure that things are consistent there with that. because if anybody gets anything wrong on the fan wiki, man, it gets challenged by a zillion people right away.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, nobody takes to mistakes on the internet. Absolutely not. Not exactly. Something they love.
You can't be wrong on the internet.
So kind of, if you were going to give some advice to the young storytellers that we have here that are just trying to find their path and to get good advice from master storytellers, kind of what would you tell them to do? How would you steer them along to making a great story and being a great storyteller?
The first thing you got to do is start looking at story craft. You don't have to do from my school of story craft. There's a lot of people who teach it very well, and they have completely different ideas about it. Sanderson, for example, has some. He agrees with some of the stuff that I do, but he has his own take on a bunch of other things. He's an amazing storyteller. But the first thing you got to do is understand that it's a craft and start learning the structure that you need in order how to write a good scene, how to write a good sequel. And that people will read and understand. And the other thing that does is it clarifies your communication with them incredibly. When you construct a good sequel, you're constructing it. It's good because it's happening in line with the natural psychological processes of the human mind. And if you can do that, then things fit in very well, and people will look at that and go, "Oh yeah, I know somebody just like that. That is a reasonable response to the situation." And it lets them buy into that story more and more and more. You know, the more verisimilitude you can put into it that way. So learn your story craft first, and then once you've got your story craft going, you know, I always suggest to new writers that they try writing something in a different genre, because it might be a breakout thing for them. So if you've been writing all fantasy, why not try some science fiction? Why not try some urban fantasy? You know, if you've been writing all action, hey, why don't you try writing a romance? Because, you know, then you're not getting your own, you know, if you're in unfamiliar territory like that, like writing a romance novel, what you want to write is the executioner novels. It forces you to apply the basic structure to it, and you can sort of see it a lot more clearly. When you're not as invested in the genre, you know, because I was a swords and horses fantasy writer, and that's what I was going to write. Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to write. You know, I was starting with an epic Tolkien-esque fantasy, and now I have an epic Tolkien-esque fantasy in mind, but I'm sort of waiting until I'm a grown-up writer to do it. I don't think I should wait too much longer though. but start there. You know, and try a bunch of different sorts of writing to apply the craft to, until you understand the craft. You should probably work some short stories, because short stories are so difficult to do. You have to do everything in a short story that you do in a novel, but you got to do it in a 20th of the space. It's like trying to have a knife fight in a phone booth. You know, I mean, that's what short stories are like. But if you can do it, then, you know, you're going to have no problem having a knife fight in the park, you know?
Right.
So, you know, novels are way easier than short stories in a lot of ways. But try your hand at different things. And once your skills are, you know, once your skills are up to par, then you have to start. And after, you know, after you're capable of writing a good story and getting a well-crafted story put together, that's when I say start writing what you love. Because, you know, write the story that your heart wants to hear, that you want to that you believe in, and because that's gonna, you know, that's gonna help carry you through. When, I mean, honestly, there's a lot of dark times when you're trying to break in as a writer, that there's no logical reason to keep going, and you just sort of have to have faith. You know, you have to have faith in the craft, in your own. Your own ideas and your own stories, and start putting those out there. But first, make sure you got your craft down. Then you can start worrying about your art. And in order to learn art, go read a lot of different people. There are people who are brilliant at all kinds of different things. You know, Terry Pratchett, the way he did humor was amazing. Mm-hmm. The way he delivered was amazing. He had like about three different techniques that he used, only like the three, but that was enough to get him a huge career for a long time. And he wrote brilliant stuff that it was kind and compassionate writing, and you really kind of like to see that. You get to somebody like David Weber, who writes the Honor Harrington series, a science fiction series. It's space opera. It's big, sprawling space opera. And he is so good at doing these different characters and at showing you, okay, well, this is how you would have to do a military operation in space. And this is what it costs and what it looks like to get things done. And here's how it interacts with politics and how frustrating it can be. And all of that, you know, he's got such skill at putting all that together. And I would teach one of his early books, Honor of the Queen. I think it was the second novel in the Honor Harrington series. And it is just structurally speaking, it is almost a perfect novel. I mean, I would use that for teaching. There's lots of different people who can do all kinds of different things that they're good at. And you can go look and see what they're good at their art and try it yourself. And try and figure out, you know, you try and figure out, how did he do that? Oh, this scene made me cry. It was so intense. How did he make that happen? And you kind of go back and start dissecting how these things get put together. Because it's not magic. It's craft. You know, it's engineering. You can figure that out.
You mentioned so many great writers in there, and you yourself are among that list. What makes a great writer?
Well, I think you got to be. I think you got to be able to fall forward when you make a mistake. You know, when you do something dumb, which I did with my first two series. that's one thing. You have to be able. You have to know people. I mean, you have to be able to look. You have to be able to be able to look at human beings and start seeing, you know, the things about them that make them human, and that way you can steal them and put them in books. You've got to be able to. I think history is the best place to go to for inspiration. Humans have done all kinds of amazing and weird and terrifying things over the years, and you can go back and read this stuff. I like to say that truth is stranger than fiction because fiction has to make sense. The actual world that has no such requirement, you know, but you can go and find inspiration and find grounding in keeping things, you know, in keeping that sort of realistic feel to it in history.
Is that what inspires you? Other people?
Often. I will just see and God knows what's going to inspire me. There are times where it's just like, you know, one night I was staying up late and I saw this whole special on the History Channel about Sue the Tyrannosaurus, you know, at the Chicago Museum. Mm-hmm. And I was working on book four when I saw that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I've got to have a dinosaur. I've got to have a dinosaur, a zombie dinosaur. Oh my gosh. And now I'm going to figure out how undead work in this world. And you start putting everything together like that. And it took me 5 years to be able to get to a point where I could write that, but I finally did. It's your inspiration. You got to take it where you can find it. And what I often suggest to young writers is that you go do something you wouldn't normally do. And it doesn't have to be big things or expensive things. Like you don't have to go, you know, base jumping in Bali or whatever. I don't know if that happens there. But one of the things that I often suggested that people do, it's like, okay, if you're writing a fantasy novel, you need to go out to the woods away from town at night and go out around sundown and sit down with your back to the woods and close your eyes and just stay there. Because things start happening to you as it gets dark, you know, as your body senses that it's getting dark and you're out in the woods and there's going to be animal sounds and there's going to be, you know, all kinds of different things. And you're going to start experiencing these, you know, much more primitive reactions that are built into people, which we don't get because we spend most of our time sitting in wooden and metal boxes. You know, that's kind of what we do. And, getting out there and waking up that part of you, you know, you're going to feel things differently. You know, I have suggested going out and LARPing to young writers, you know, because I don't know what it feels like, necessarily to fight a goblin hand to hand and kill it. But I do know what it feels like to be crouching in ambush in the woods next to a trail with a sword in my hand and waiting for my prey to get close enough and you know, being really still and being very overexcited and really having to pee and my knees and ankles hurting, but I've got to stay crouched. And you know, I know what that feels like. And so I can bring that to a story. And to finally get to jump up and have the adrenaline surge and to go into a sword fight and to realize that your feet are asleep and fall over and look like an idiot. I know from LARPing that the Jedi would have a really hard time in any kind of real military conflict, because if you've got a glowing sword and it's at night, everybody with a bow and arrow shoots at you because they can't see anyone else. So you're going to get shot. that's what's going to happen. And if you don't get shot, every mosquito in the valley is going to see that light and come over towards it and going to find you.
It's tough to be a Jedi everywhere.
Yeah, these are things that you don't think about when you watch the Star Wars movies, but there it is. I've gone out and fought people at night with a glowing sword and found out that those are the things that happen.
So really, just again, experience in doing your work, experience life experiences, people experiences, just really being out there and having all of that affect you, which affects your work, right? Helps you create better stories.
Absolutely. And you pay attention. You look around and you pay attention. You go people watch and you see what you can deduce about people from looking at them. Just going and sitting at the mall can be fascinating. And this is all stuff that, I've done over time. And, I these days it's easier because you can do it on the internet. You can do a lot of it on the internet. Although, the internet is, as long as you understand that the internet is essentially a place of kabuki theater where everybody's over the top, then, and it is like the mightiest tempest in a teapot that humanity's ever developed is the internet, so you can kind of see how people are there. I swear to God, what the internet needs is not a touch screen, but a punch screen, so that when somebody gets too lippy, you can kind of punch them through the screen. And I think it would be a lot more polite if the internet would be a much more polite place if that technology existed.
What is your favorite story and why?
I always get this question, and it's always a different answer because it depends on, I have a fairly large constellation of stories that I love and reread and keep close to me. I would say some of my favorites are the Spencer books by Robert B. Parker. He wrote a hard-boiled detective started in the early 70s, he rolled up until 2000. I think he died in 2008. At the keyboard working on his next novel, like a man. that's how I want to go out.
But, exactly.
He wrote these books that were, very, very, very high on banter, that would take on very difficult subjects, that were super rich in subtext, and that talked a lot about masculinity and how to be a decent man in a healthy way. He would write about, this is what it means to be a badass and to do it responsibly. And those were great. I mean, they were great for that. Let me think. Dean Koontz's book, a lot of Dean Koontz's books I love, but the one that I love most is Watchers.
God, I'm so glad you said that. I love Watchers, too.
Oh, my God. That is in my top three books always.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, the movies are so bad, but the book is amazing.
Because dogs.
Okay, yes, because dogs.
There's dogs and monsters and monsters trying to kill dogs and brave, kind people defending them. It's like, okay, that's a great story.
Yeah, it
right
is.
There. Yeah, let's go. Let me think. I go back to Tolkien and C.S. Lewis a lot. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lloyd Alexander's Pride Inn Chronicles, I think, are excellent coming-of-age novels for young men. Right now, I'm rereading Horatio Hornblower, that whole series. Mm-hmm. Those were written, I think, in the 1950s, something like that. And I'm having a great time reading those. Let me think. I read Weber, Correa, Sanderson, Rothfuss whenever he writes something. Pat's a brilliant writer. I'm very jealous of Pat because he can write that really, really tight, clean, hardcore pulp style. Mm-hmm. And then a page later switched to this lyrical literary style where, you know, where he uses words as poetry, which is something that I'd never been very good at. And he's amazing at it. And so I'm in awe of somebody whose mind can encompass both of those at the same time. My own son is writing now, and I'm enjoying his books. I might have influenced him a little.
What is it like watching the second generation, your own progeny, do exactly what you did? What is it like seeing kind of that person come along?
Well, I mean, he's my son, and I adore him. Whatever he did, I would be there. I'd be supporting him. Mm-hmm. I'm terribly proud that he thought that my way of life was something that was, you know, worth following, and worth taking such chances on, you know. And I'm incredibly proud of how he's doing. I mean, he's doing very, very well.
Yes, he is.
First couple of months. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's blown the sales of my first several books away completely. And, you know, actually, I think he's a little bit better writer than me. Certainly, he's a better writer than I was at his age. I think I'm going to be writing his coattails 10 years from now.
I'm sure Stephen King is going through the same thing with his son.
It very, very well might be.
So I'm going to ask you a question related to your books. But before I do, since I have a fellow Dean Koontz fan, let me also recommend Lightning if you've never read it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right up there with Watcher. Is one of my favorites.
And what was the name of the one with the voodoo, the evil voodoo priest, the Bokor?
Oh God, yes. I hadn't thought about that in years.
Was it Twilight?
I think it was. Twilight was definitely one of them, for sure.
Yeah, but it was one of those. And that one was—I mean, that was the book that inspired, you know, Michael Carpenter for the Dresden Files.
Gosh, talk about prolific! My goodness, Dean Koontz.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I admire him tremendously. Wish he'd had better luck when it came to getting his books made into movies.
Who is your favorite character? If it's not Harry, who is it?
It depends on what kind of perspective I'm looking at him from. If it's just the one that I most want to be real, it's Michael Carpenter, mm-hmm. or Mouse. I've got a very near Mouse right now in my life. I'm very lucky for. I've got a pit bull named Brutus.
Awesome.
You know, he's this giant, hugely muscular pit bull, and he is the biggest baby you've ever seen, and the sweetest dog. He's so careful around babies. It's adorable. And he's offered to fight bears for me twice, you know. So he's a hero for me.
That is a hero.
If I'm talking about characters that are fun to write, I love writing Bob the Skull. I love writing Mab. I love writing Marcone. Because they are all characters who are, they're a mix of dark and light, and they're often exasperating to Dresden, and they often enjoy exasperating Dresden. So they're always very fun to write because then I get to write Dresden's reactions to whatever insanity they're up to as well, and that's always fun. I love writing frenemy characters. Frenemies are the most fun to work with. Because you never quite know what's going to happen with them, and that always creates tension between them and the other characters they're interacting with, and that's a great deal of fun.
You have written and published at this point dozens of novels and created hundreds of characters over the course of 25 years, I think, at this point. Over all of that time, what would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned about writing and storytelling?
Keep it simple. That's easy. Keep it simple. When you're developing stuff, you know, keep your sentences simple. Keep them, you know, you don't need to make them long and complicated. Sometimes I do, because that's just sort of how my brain works. But especially when you're doing big, impactful things, don't go for the big language while you're doing that. Because what you want is to make a movie play in the reader's head. And if the reader keeps getting distracted by little speed bumps of words they don't know, or things they're not sure how to pronounce, or weird sentence structures that they have to straighten out in their brain, the more that happens, the more it draws them away from those big moments. And when you've been working, you know, for 6 months to write a book that leads up to this one big moment, you want to make sure that thing hits. because you put the work on that. And so when you get to there, you know, like when you get to the end of Changes, where Harry has to deal with Susan, and you write about that, you know, I could have gone on with pages and pages of paragraphs and emotions, and instead what I did was, you know, I closed that out with, I think, 6 or 7 very short sentences, just sort of written back to back, and to really, you know, drive home that impact. Because, you know, you give the reader what happens, and you know, they get to develop whatever is most emotionally effective in their own brain to go along with the feelings you've been encouraging this whole time. So, you know, when it comes to the big stuff, don't try and get fancy with it. Keep it simple.
Wow. Sir, this is endlessly fascinating to me. I could talk to you about yourself and your craft and your work for hours, literally. But instead of doing that, I just want to let you know how much I've enjoyed this conversation. I want to extend to you an invitation to please join us here at the schoolhouse. If you're ever in the area, we would love for you to come and talk to our students and share any of this knowledge with them. And before I let you go, I definitely want to ask our most famous question that we share with all of our students to always ask before they let someone go, which is there anything that you would like to add that we've forgotten to ask you, or anything that you want to talk about?
No, not really. I mean, I'm honestly, I'm a ridiculous human being in many ways. And I've over the years kind of purpose built myself just to write these stories. and that's what I love doing. I will say that, the very best part of this job is when people will, you know, somebody will come up to me and say, "Hey man, you know, I was in Afghanistan losing my mind, and these stories, you know, these stories helped me get through it and come back home in one piece. Thank you." Or, "Listen, my dad was dying, and I hadn't seen him in 20 years, and we had never connected on anything. But he read your books, and I read your books, and we sat down and read them together before the end, and we built our relationship back." And this is all stuff that I didn't mean to happen. I mean, I just want to write my silly wizard stories and get paid. But that's the best part of the job, is seeing seeds that I planted that maybe I didn't even know I was planting at the time grow up into trees, and other people can take shade under them. It's not something that I intended to do, but it's one of the good side effects of art, and it is one of the most deeply satisfying things you can feel as an artist. Oh, wow, what I did actually helped them when they were in a really bad place. That's what it's all about.
Absolutely. Sir, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure that our students and our listeners are going to get so much from that conversation, and I really can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Oh, you too.